I'm Taylor.
I'm Kat.
And welcome to Square Mile of Murder. We are here. You are here. Everyone is here. So let's do this. We are rounding out our month on Sky Crimes by examining what is perhaps one of the most famous Sky Crimes, if not one of the most famous or infamous unsolved crimes of the last 50 years. Even the FBI has referred to it as the greatest unsolved mystery in the history of the Bureau. And if they're saying that, you know it's a big deal. Today, we are talking about one of my personal favorite crimes ever. The hijacking of Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305, or NORJAC, or as you may know it, the story of D.B. Cooper. There's a lot here, so we should just do it.
Yeah. So, Thanksgiving, the fourth Thursday of November, is a day to spend with your loved ones, eat your weight in turkey and pies, potatoes, day drink. So that's kind of like those of us who are not American. That's what we are led to believe Thanksgiving is all about. But for one man, passing out in a turkey-flavoured food coma was not on his to-do list for Thanksgiving 1971.
No.
On the afternoon of Wednesday, November 24th, 1971, Thanksgiving Eve, a man named Dan Cooper purchased a one-way ticket in cash for Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305 from Portland International Airport to SeaTac International Airport in Seattle. Now, for those of us who grew up in a post-9/11 world, the idea that you could just rock up at an airport, buy a ticket in cash, and board a plane without showing ID or going through like that anxiety-inducing security screening process that seemingly makes all of us panic that we've accidentally like packed, I don't know, liquid sarin gas or a machete or a homemade pipe bomb in our hand luggage. It seems insane.
Yeah.
Because for most of us, like 30 and under, 35 and under maybe, that's what we've grown up around. Like we were 10 when 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
So I never went on a plane till I was 15.
Yeah.
So, and they were just starting to relax security a bit then from what it was immediately after 9/11.
Yeah.
So the idea that you can just walk, like just turn up at the airport, just like, yeah, it's like it was like $20.
Yeah.
Just waddle on. Nobody looked in his briefcase, anything like that. Nobody, you know, didn't have to take his belt and his sunglasses and everything off. Just walked straight on. That's exactly how you did it back then.
It is, you know, my dad used to fly a lot for work for decades, like through 60s and 70s. But he got to the point where he was traveling so much that like he would regularly call the airport and say things like, "Hey guys, I'm running late. Hold the plane for me." And they fucking did.
Wow.
That's like how different it was. And that would have been in like the 80s. So,
yeah.
And like, even when I flew a lot pre 9/11 as a kid, like you still had to go through security, as in like metal detectors, you know, take your coins out of your pockets kind of thing. But it was never that intensive. And like, you could go to the gates without a ticket.
Yeah, that always amuses me when you watch like old sitcoms like from the 90s
and stuff where they're
where they're like running to the gate and I'm like, how did you get there?
Yeah.
Or they're meeting someone off the plane at the gate and I'm like, but how?
Yeah, I used to do that all the time. It's a different world.
Yeah.
So the Boeing 727-100. Or perhaps airplane people would correct me and say that should be said the Boeing 727-100 or 100. I don't know plane language. It was a plane. It took off. It departed on time, in fact, for the short flight to Seattle. Although sources vary on what time on time actually was, but basically it was sometime between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. So Cooper was one of 36 passengers along with the small airline crew. Shortly after takeoff, Cooper ordered a bourbon and soda and then handed a note to flight attendant Florence Schaffner. But Schaffner just put the note in her pocket without reading it. But after seeing Schaffner put the piece of paper in her pocket, Cooper leaned closer to her and whispered, "Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb."
So this is quite an important distinction to make. So according to all the sources we use, he just kind of whispered it to her. Like, look at that note, I have a bomb, sit down. Not screaming along the aisle, "Miss, I have a bomb." Which some podcasts and YouTubers seem to go down that route.
What? Like, no.
I have not read that anywhere else.
No, that's definitely not what happened because the passengers weren't aware of what was going on.
No.
So I think they would have noticed that.
Yeah.
We're not sure, / nobody really knows exactly what the note said because Cooper later took it back. But we know that after telling Schaffner about the bomb, Cooper insisted that she sit beside him. After sitting down, Schaffner asked to see the bomb, and Cooper briefly opened his black attaché case, the only possession he had taken on board with him, just long enough for her to glimpse the 8 red cylinders inside, believed to be dynamite, attached to a battery via a set of wires. So, it's pretty bomb-like, although that is very, like, cartoon bomb.
Yeah, so...
So who knows?
But you wouldn't take that risk, would you?
No, not in an airplane. Definitely not. So, after showing Schaffner the bomb, Cooper explained how it would work and then made his demands. $200,000 in cash, which is worth about $1.4 million today. 4 parachutes and a fuel truck standing by ready to refuel when they landed at SeaTac. He also is reported to have said, "No funny stuff or I'll do the job." Because it's the 70s, eh?
Yeah.
Was it 71, right?
Yeah.
Schaffner relayed these demands to Captain William A. Scott, who contacted air traffic control, who then in turn contacted local and federal authorities. Quickly, the ransom payment was authorized, and the airline instructed staff to comply with Cooper's demands. Passengers were told that their arrival at SeaTac would be delayed, and the plane circled the Puget Sound for 2 hours while the FBI gathered and photographed the ransom money from a number of banks in Seattle. Now, the bills weren't marked, but their serial numbers were recorded, and that will become important later.
Yeah. More than 2 hours late, the plane finally landed in Seattle, which is quite a long time to be circling Seattle when the Portland to Seattle flight is like less than an hour. It's 50-some minutes.
Yeah, you could just go back and forth.
Like, if that's like flying from like Newcastle to Amsterdam or Dublin or London. Like, if I was on one of those flights and I was like circling around for 2 hours, I'd be like, why?
Yeah.
Just why? Like you say, you could go back and come back again.
Yeah.
That was too late. So Cooper had instructed the crew to close all the window blinds to discourage the feds from having snipers trying to shoot him, because they did have snipers there on the tarmac in case the opportunity arose. Al Lee, who was the airline's Seattle operations manager, delivered the backpack filled with the ransom money to the runway, along with the 4 parachutes. And flight attendant Tina Mucklow collected the money and parachutes and then went back on board to give to Cooper. And once Cooper had them all, he allowed the passengers and some of the crew, including flight attendant Florence Schaffner, to deplane. Because I think when they landed, they were told it was a mechanical issue, mm-hmm, as to why they couldn't yet deplane.
Mm-hmm.
and while the plane was being refueled, which took longer than Cooper anticipated and began to irritate him, he outlined the flight plan to the crew still on board. The plane was to head for Mexico City, but Cooper had some conditions for the flight. Now, according to the Wikipedia page on DB Cooper, he said the plane had to travel as slow as possible without stalling, which is about 115 miles an hour, 185 kilometres, at a maximum of 10,000 feet. The landing gear was to remain deployed. Once in the air, they couldn't lift it. The wing flaps were to be lowered to 15 degrees, and the cabin was to remain unpressurised. The wing flaps I have no understanding of, so, you know.
I think they produce drag, right? It just slows it down.
Yeah, it's all to do with balance and things like that. Like, they can adjust them for, like, turbulence or clouds and things, but... So it's someone who actually knows something about...
Yeah. Clearly this isn't his first time on an airplane, and he probably has some experience with them.
He also demanded that the air stair remain extended with the rear exit door open, but the airline refused as it was too dangerous. So the crew showed Cooper how to operate it before they took off again.
Unfortunately, there was a problem. The plane's range was only about 1,000 miles, and it would not make it to Mexico without stopping to refuel. So eventually, the Reno Tahoe International Airport was agreed on as a suitable refueling stop. Just after 7:40 p.m., the plane took off from SeaTac with Cooper and a four-person crew of Captain William A. Scott, First Officer William J. Radizak, Flight Engineer Harold E. Anderson, and Flight Attendant Tina Mucklow. After takeoff, Cooper instructed Mucklow to join the rest of the crew in the cockpit. Then at around 8 p.m., warning lights flashed in the cockpit, indicating that the air stair had been activated. The pilot used the intercom to ask if Cooper needed assistance, but he replied no. And this was the last time that anyone spoke to Cooper. Unbeknownst to Cooper, the plane was being tailed by two F-106 fighter jets, one above and one below the Boeing 727, out of view of the plane's crew and Cooper, and a Lockheed T-33, all of which had been diverted from unrelated training missions. But all three military planes had to turn back at the Oregon border due to low fuel levels. So, the plane landed at Reno Tahoe at around 10:15 p.m. and was immediately surrounded by both local law enforcement and FBI officials.
There was no sign of Cooper on board, and officials were confident that he could not have escaped after the plane landed without anyone on the ground seeing him. So a half-hour sweep of the plane was conducted. Cooper, the money, the briefcase, the bomb, and two of the parachutes had all gone. But they did find 65 unidentified fingerprints, and Cooper's clip-on tie was also found, because all villains know you gotta just have a clip-on to get rid of quickly.
Yeah, obviously.
And one of the two parachutes that were still on board had been opened. So the crew were all interviewed that evening, and composite sketches were developed from Tina Mucklow and Florence Schaffner's almost identical descriptions. Now, according to BuzzFeed, these sketches were believed to be incredibly accurate. We'll get to that later as well. And the most accurate of all the descriptions of Cooper, as, you know, he spent quite a long time with each of them during the two flights and while on the ground at SeaTac, compared to description from the other members of the crew and from fellow passengers who, you know, didn't actually know anything had happened till they deplaned and the feds met them like, oh, so your plane was just hijacked.
Yeah, right? With surprise. Mm.
But the two flight attendants described Cooper as being in his mid-40s, around 5'10" to 6 feet tall, weighing about 180 pounds, with piercing brown eyes. He was wearing a black suit with a white shirt, loafers and sunglasses. They also both described him as calm and polite, and not like many of the stereotypes of hijackers at that time, which were usually like the hardened criminals or political dissidents heading for Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Mucklow had actually asked Cooper if he had a grudge against Northwest Orient Airlines, to which he replied, "I don't have a grudge against your airline, miss. I just have a grudge." Interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. So the sketches and description were circulated quickly as police began tracking down potential suspects. One of the first suspects was an Oregon man named D.B. Cooper, who had a minor criminal record, and the police contacted him on the off chance that the hijacker had used his real name, or the same alias as his previous crimes. The name was cleared, but a local reporter had accidentally mixed up the names of the hijacker and this initial suspect, and this mistake was then repeated by a reporter from Wire Service United Press Agency, which is why we now know the hijacker as D.B. Cooper rather than Dan Cooper.
Yeah, I think D.B. sounds a lot cooler than Dan.
Yeah, like...
like, if it was Dan Cooper, I don't think people would get as excited about this as they do.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's very, like, it adds to the myth in a way. Now, because the crew were all in the cockpit and the diverted military planes had had to land due to fuel shortages, nobody was sure exactly when Cooper jumped from the plane. And even if he had jumped while the military planes were still trailing the Boeing, the limited visibility of the cloudy night sky meant that it was possible for someone to jump without being seen. The crew had reported a sudden upward motion that required intervention from the pilot to correct shortly after 8 p.m. when the air stairs were lowered. Now, it's possible that this was Cooper jumping, but it's also possible that this was just normal air disturbance that, you know, you experience on all flights. Also, the stairs were open, so that's gonna make it more of a bumpy ride.
Yeah, definitely. But when authorities carried out a recreation of the flight from SeaTac to Reno Tahoe, they pushed a sled weighing about 200 pounds out of an open air stair, and this resulted in a similar upward motion and brief change in pressure that the crew had experienced at around like 8:15. This gave investigators a rough search area around southwest Washington, northwest Oregon, which is also the area where the military planes had to turn back to avoid running out of fuel in midair, which is not good.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Now, the pilots of the military planes did not see anyone jump, nor did they detect a parachute on their radar, but it is possible that a person dressed all in black could jump without being seen. And if they didn't open the parachute until as late as possible, they could have literally flown under the radar and avoided detection. And it is also worth noting that although Mexico City was the final destination and Reno Tahoe was agreed upon as a refueling stop, Cooper had no input on the actual flight path, and the route was chosen by the flight crew, meaning that Cooper didn't demand the plane take a particular path so that he could like coordinate his jump with accomplices waiting for him on the ground.
Yeah. When they did the recreation and they shoved this 200-pound sled out of a plane just out into the open, like, I hope the sled had a parachute, because otherwise that's dangerous. Like, I know you're over
that's
the
like
woods.
A mini crater.
But like, you're dropping a fucking projectile out of a plane. Just onto the unsuspecting ground. Yeah, so basically it sounds like either he was confident enough that he could, from anywhere along that route, he could, you know, make his escape, or potentially he wasn't interested in surviving the jump.
Yeah. And I believe it was this case where all the other planes in the area were told avoid. They obviously avoid each other to a certain extent, but get well out of this plane's flight path.
Yeah.
Don't look at it. Don't watch it. Don't just stay as far away from it as possible.
Yeah.
Unless he had like many people stationed all along.
That would be
the route
like
between SeaTac and Mexico City.
That would be like a world record for number of accomplices.
Like
so one of those hands kind of across the world, like chains of people just waiting for him to make his jump. That's what I'm picturing.
Yeah, so despite extensive searches along the flight path between Seattle and Reno, involving ground and air assets from local, state, and federal law enforcement, as well as local branches of the National Guard, no sign of Cooper, his parachute, or his briefcase bomb were ever found.
So, this is something that I've never really thought about before. But he supposedly jumped with this bomb. So, like,
you'd have to have a good grip on it.
You'd either have to have a good grip on it. You'd either or know that it was fake, or be confident that you could, like, fling it away from you as you fell through the air and it would land far enough away that it wouldn't fucking blow you up. Like, I never thought about it.
Or make sure it's very disconnected.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, I never really thought about that either.
But that just adds a whole nother layer to it. Cause I feel like I always forget about the bomb by the time they've like landed and taken off again and he's asked for the parachutes and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So yeah, disappeared without a trace. But they did find something. They found some of the money. So serial numbers for the bills were released to the public. Northwest Orient offered a reward of 15% of whatever recovered money people found, up to $25,000. And numerous media outlets also offered rewards to anyone who could turn in one of the bills. Although there was at least one attempt to turn in counterfeit bills and collect the reward money, nobody ever turned in the money actually paid out in the hijacking. However, in February 1980, a family who were vacationing on the Columbia River in southern Washington found three packets of cash on a beach known as Tina Bar, which was about 20 miles away from the community of Ariel, which was one of the places investigators suspected Cooper could have landed had he jumped when the crew felt the sudden upward movement and change in cabin pressure. These three packets contained almost $6,000, but the money had deteriorated and begun to rot due to the 9 years exposure in a damp environment. Further examination of the bills revealed that they had been in the river and deposited on the riverbank by river movement rather than intentionally placed there or dropped there from the air, bringing up more questions than answers. This has led some to believe that Cooper may have landed in the Washougal Valley or around the Washougal River, which flows into the Columbia River, not too far away from Tina Bar where the money was found. But the valley has been extensively searched numerous times with no sign of Cooper or his parachute. Wasn't it something like a little 10-year-old kid found this money?
Yeah, they were looking for like firewood.
Oh yeah,
to build a barbecue or something on this little beach.
River beach. Just like, that's a pretty.
Yes, we found all this money. Oh, it's rotting and it was used in a hijacking.
That's rotting and it's ill-begotten.
I do think it's incredible that they can work out from the state of it and how it's positioned, like how it's come to be there.
Yeah.
Like that it's been moved, by the river rather than being dropped there, and it's probably flowed from the Washougal into the Columbia.
Yeah.
I just think that's incredible. Yeah. That like science, like we know science is amazing and can do amazing things, but to like just know that you can work out where something entered a river and how it moved, I think is really impressive.
Yeah, super interesting.
So, despite the fingerprints recovered from the plane and a partial DNA profile recovered from the clip-on tie that was left on the plane before he jumped, Dan, or DB Cooper, has never been identified. So initially, the crime Cooper was to be charged with was hijacking, or air piracy as it's also known. But that had a 5-year statute of limitation. So in November 1976, as the 5-year limit rapidly approached, a grand jury was convened and John Doe, aka Dan Cooper, was indicted in absentia for violating the Hobbs Act. Mm-hmm. Now, the Hobbs Act is a federal statute criminalizing robbery and extortion, which has no statute of limitation. No doubt the reason, or in part, the reason that it was chosen.
Yeah.
As what he was indicted for.
Can you imagine if, like, they just let that run out, that clock run out?
Mm.
I wonder if we would know who he was at that point. Because there would be no...
Yeah, maybe.
There'd be no consequence for it.
So, the FBI continued to investigate and attempt to identify Cooper for almost 45 years before closing the case in July 2016, citing the need to refocus resources on more urgent priorities.
I remember when this happened, I was like, no, they can't close it. But also,
yeah,
it's been long enough.
However, they will continue to investigate if they receive credible new information and evidence. Which, like, yeah, I get why people are pissed if they close a case like that, but also after 45 years, there's no money being recovered, there's no trace, even the parachute.
Yeah.
Like, okay, if he just rocketed to the ground, yes, he would die. His body could be scavenged by animals. Even the bones could all have been taken away, mm-hmm. and, you know, separated by animal scavenging. That parachute, or at least something of it, should have been found.
Yeah.
So if they haven't found that after 45 years, I think it's like there are definitely more urgent things going on now that they need to spend their money and time
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
But during the 45-year-long investigation, more than 1,000 suspects were investigated and eliminated, along with a number of hoaxers. Two of the most well-known hoaxers were Donald Murphy and William Lewis, who in November 1972 impersonated Cooper in order to sell a tell-all story to the media. They were both arrested and charged with extortion.
Fair enough. There were also a number of deathbed confessions from men who claimed to be D.B. Cooper or to know something about the case, but then died before giving any more information. One of these deathbed confessions came from Dwayne L. Weber, who 3 days before his death in 1995 said to his wife, Jo, "I am Dan Cooper." At the time, she didn't realize the significance of his confession, but in the months following his death, she told a friend about the confession, and they explained to her who Dan Cooper was. So, Jo went to a local library to research the case, where she found a book on the case with her husband's writing in the margins.
That is incredible.
Yeah. Like, that's wild.
I also wonder if, like, because he said, "I am Dan Cooper." Uh-huh. I wonder if that's why she didn't realize at the time.
Yeah.
Like, because it's just become known as D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, I'm sure. Like, I think probably only people who actually spent time actively, like, reading about the case or hearing about the case in some way would probably. Because it was still, even after it was realized that, like, that was the wrong name, it still stuck.
Yeah. And also it depends, like, what he was dying from. Because if he had, like, say, Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia, mm-hmm. she could have just thought it was...
Yeah, just random.
Just the ramblings of someone who was literally losing their grip on reality.
Yeah. So, yeah, so she found this book about the case. He had made some notes in the margins. He also had the criminal background the FBI believed that Cooper had, having served 6 prison sentences for burglary and forgery between 1945 and 1968. And he was a bourbon drinker.
I think every suspect, they're like, he was a bourbon drinker.
Yeah. Like, I take issue with that because it was the 70s, late 60s, 70s. Like, what white man in America wasn't a bourbon drinker and a chain smoker? Like, that yeah. was literally everybody. So I kind of discount that part of it. It's like, oh, well, he drank the same drink, but like. Right, so his wife Jo also recalled the couple took a trip in 1979 to Seattle and then the Columbia River in southern Washington State, just a few miles from where the money was eventually found on Tina Bar Beach. However,
interesting.
It is very interesting. However, Weber was eliminated by the FBI in 1998 when his fingerprints did not match any recovered from the plane. Nor did his DNA match the partial profile recovered from the clip-on tie left on board when Cooper jumped.
Now, obviously, we cannot look at all of the suspects because, as we said before, over 1,000 of them have been cleared. I think there was about 25 on the list who haven't been cleared.
Yeah.
We don't even have time to do all them. But we've rounded up a few of the names and faces favoured by law enforcement, armchair detectives, and of course ourselves. So let's take a look.
Yes. Okay. So one of the more popular suspects is Robert Rackstraw, a Vietnam vet who was a paratrooper, pilot, and explosives expert. It's a triple threat.
Mm-hmm.
He first came to the attention of the FBI in 1978 when he was extradited from Iran back to the U.S. on charges of check kiting and possession of explosives. While on bail, he tried to fake his own death by making a false mayday call while flying a rented plane over Monterey Bay in California and claiming that he was bailing out. And this is my favorite part. The plane was later found repainted in a nearby hangar. And Rackstraw was rearrested, and forging a pilot's license was added to the list of offenses he was to stand trial for.
I love
that. I just
love
it. It's just like, just gave it a new paint job and parked it up.
Mm.
Like,
yeah. Yeah, because they don't have, like, numbers engraved yeah. like cars, you yeah. know, onto the chassis and in the engine covers and, you know, things that people would scrape off if they were trying to do an actual good job of
yeah,
this.
You know, it's fine. So the FBI noted the similarities between Rackstraw and the profile they had initially created of Cooper, including criminal background, military parachute training, as well as similarities between him and the composite sketches of Cooper. But the following year, he was eliminated as a suspect when there was no actual direct evidence pointing towards him, only circumstantial evidence. Also, the flight attendants did not identify him as Cooper, and he was only 28 at the time, whereas the flight crew believed that Cooper was in his 40s. People seemed to forget about Rackstraw for more than 40 years. But in 2016, his name came up again when a documentary was aired and a book was released, both listing him as the only suspect in the D.B. Cooper case. Whoever did those sort of missed 999 other folks, didn't they?
Mm. Yes. And that was Thomas Colbert, who in 2017, along with a group of volunteers, found what they believed to be part of Cooper's parachute strap at an undisclosed location in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, sure.
Like, that's not a good... Like, you need to disclose your locations. And later, they uncovered a piece of foam believed to be part of the parachute backpack, also found in an undisclosed Pacific Northwest location.
Yeah.
Yeah, not buying it. Colbert also claims to have a letter from Rackstraw where he confesses to being Cooper. This letter was supposedly written using code, which Rackstraw would have used in Vietnam, and was cracked by one of Colbert's volunteers, who was also a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah. Sure.
But not everyone is convinced. Me, if you can't tell. I think Taylor's not convinced either.
No, not.
Just from the faces you're making.
I'm not convinced by this quote-unquote recent evidence. Like, the initial, yeah, like, matchups of him is kind of convincing, although he does seem like he's too young. But if he lived a hard, yeah, life, like a lot of people did back in the day, then maybe he looked older.
Yeah. And also, when you look at people from, like, the 60s and 70s, like, oh, they were in their 30s, and I'm like, were they? They look like they're in their,
yeah,
50s.
Yeah.
Like, I think people don't... People seem to age differently. I don't mean just in terms of, like, cosmetic surgery and, like, anti-wrinkle creams and things. I just think people look different,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, no.
At, like, certain ages to, like, say, like, 50 years ago.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, according to an article by All That's Interesting, which is linked below in the show notes, Covert claims he has embarrassed the FBI by managing to solve the D.B. Cooper case with his group of amateur investigator sleuths, while the FBI agents had been unable to for, you know, 45 years. And now there is a high-level cover-up to save face.
Obviously.
I mean, they eliminated him nearly 40 years earlier, so yeah. I think that's got more to do,
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, maybe that's possible.
Maybe. Rackstraw denied Corbett's claims, although he had been happy previously for people to think that just maybe he could have been D.B. Cooper, dancing around questions and suggestions that he could have been the hijacker. Can neither confirm nor deny. But following Corbett's book, he said he lost his boat repair business because people didn't want to go to him because they thought he was a hijacker.
Yeah.
And, you know, a literal domestic terrorist.
Yeah.
And he died of heart disease in July 2019 in his mid-70s.
Okay, so another and quite recently named suspect, and this one is my sort of long-held favorite, is Kenneth Christensen, whose own brother Lyle became convinced that Kenneth was Cooper after seeing a rerun of the Unsolved Mysteries episode about D.B. Cooper.
And the link to that episode on YouTube is in the show notes as well, if you want to check that out. There's a few interesting things on that episode.
Yeah. So his brother Kenneth had died in 1994, and on his deathbed had said, "There is something you should know, but I cannot tell you." Lyle...
And then he died.
And didn't tell him. Lyle became convinced that this partial confession was related to the D.B. Cooper case. But the FBI weren't interested, and neither were a number of filmmakers and authors that Lyle contacted in the hopes that they would be interested in the film or book possibilities of the story. Eventually, he hired P.I. Skip Porteous, who in 2010 published a book about his investigation. So, Kenneth Christensen had been a flight attendant and a flight purser for Northwest Orient, but he had previously been a plane mechanic, and he had the military background that law enforcement thought D.B. Cooper would have had, having served as a paratrooper during the Second World War. Christensen was 45 at the time of the hijacking. He smoked and drank bourbon, as Cooper did, although he was shorter and thinner than the hijacker, as described by the flight attendants. Florence Schaffner has reportedly said that Christensen matched her memory of Cooper more closely than any of the other suspects whose photos she had looked at, but she couldn't conclusively say yes or no.
Interestingly, in the Unsolved Mysteries episode, which originally aired in 1988, that covers D.B. Cooper, Florence Schaffner said that the famous sketch of D.B. Cooper, which was widely believed to be incredibly accurate, yeah, is not actually that accurate. Which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And also, we've talked before about the accuracy of sketch, like composite sketches and things like that, and people being like, oh, it looks just like him.
I don't see it.
Does it really? Yeah. But anyway, the FBI did not consider Christensen a prime suspect, despite Schaffner saying that he more closely matched the hijacker than anyone else's photo that she had been shown. And they cited a lack of direct evidence linking Christensen, and also said he did not match eyewitness descriptions of Cooper. Despite Florence Schaffner saying
that he did.
Yeah, it looks a lot like him, but I'm not 100% sure. So, anyway. Also, by 2010, the FBI had significantly rewritten their criminal profile of Cooper. And whilst it was believed he had some kind of military parachute training, they did not believe him to be as experienced or skilled a jumper as they had done in the 70s. And Christian had what's been described as a level of skydiving experience above that predicted by the profile.
Yeah. Which is interesting that they sort of rewrote that profile over time. See, I think Christensen is interesting because he worked for Northwest Orient. And, like, he had been a flight attendant. He'd been a purser. So, like, he would have been very familiar with their planes, with their fleet, with their sort of, like, systems of operation and processes and flight schedules and all this stuff. Mm. And, like, and I kind of remember reading somewhere along the way that, like, he had been fired by the company or something, I think.
Oh, and so, I maybe missed that.
I don't know if that's right, but it just seems kind of somewhere in the dredges of my brain. Mm. But, like, but the only thing is, then when he was asked, do you have a grudge against Northwest Orient? He's like, no. But also, are we taking the word of a hijacker?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
It depends how much weight you want to put on that claim. Because if he said yes, that gives them a massive head start.
Yeah.
Who has a grudge that couldn't be settled in any other way than literally hijacking a plane? Like, there will be some paper trail of who has that kind of grievance.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So, yeah. But, yeah, just the fact that he's a flight attendant, he was a paratrooper, and he was familiar with the airline at the time really stands out to me. So, he's a possible. He's my pick.
Mm. Yeah, it's your pick.
Now, the final suspect that we're going to look at, who is favored by some former FBI agents and many armchair detectives, including Kat.
Yeah.
This one is Richard McCoy Jr. So, Richard McCoy was a Vietnam veteran who served two tours with the U.S. Army. The first as an explosives expert and the second as a helicopter pilot. And he was also an avid skydiver. Okay, three checks right there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't his military record that brought him to the attention of the feds. It was, in fact, the hijacking of another Boeing 727 less than 5 months after Cooper hijacked Flight 305. On April 7th, 1972, United Airlines Flight 855 from Newark to LAX landed in Denver for a scheduled stopover, where McCoy boarded the plane using the alias James Johnson. Once the plane was up in the air, McCoy hijacked the plane, but rather than a bomb, that like what was used in the Cooper case, used an unloaded handgun and a novelty paperweight that looked like a hand grenade. Sure. He demanded $500,000 in cash and 4 parachutes, which were delivered to him after the plane landed at San Francisco International Airport. Once the plane was back in the air, we're not exactly sure where it was heading for, because McCoy had ordered the pilot to fly east in a zigzag pattern.
There's also a lot less information about this hijacking as there is about Northwest Orient. So
makes sense.
Not in as much detail.
But once we... No, I wasn't there. Once they were in the air and flying over Provo, Utah, McCoy jumped from the air stairs. But there was kind of a problem. McCoy had left his fingerprints on the magazine he had been reading and on the note that he had handed to the flight attendant. And he was arrested 2 days later after a tip-off from a motorist who had picked up McCoy hitchhiking while wearing a jumpsuit. So, whoops.
Yeah. So, McCoy always professed his innocence, but was found guilty of air piracy and sentenced to 45 years in prison. There were a number of similarities between the two hijackings. Both Cooper and McCoy hijacked and parachuted out of a Boeing 727. They both requested 4 parachutes along with large sums of money they were extorting, used notes to alert flight attendants to their weapons, and they remained fairly calm throughout the entire hijacking. Now, according to BuzzFeed, both notes also contained the phrase, "no funny stuff," which, just very 70s.
Yeah.
Or just very old and timey.
Yeah.
Before our time. Now, despite these similarities, the FBI ruled him out, citing a lack of resemblance to the sketch of D.B. Cooper, and there being credible evidence that McCoy was in Las Vegas, and then back home with his family in Utah for Thanksgiving the following day. Now, 2 years into his 45-year sentence, in August 1974... McCoy and 3 accomplices commandeered a garbage truck and escaped from Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. 2 of the group, Joseph Harville and Larry Bagley, were recaptured 3 days later, but McCoy and the 4th member of the group, Melvin Walker, remained on the run for 3 months. When the FBI finally tracked them down in Virginia Beach, McCoy was shot dead in a shootout with agents. Walker escaped but was recaptured after a short car chase. Now, the FBI agent who shot and killed McCoy allegedly said, we don't know how true this is, I couldn't actually find his name either. "When I shot Richard McCoy, I shot D.B. Cooper at the same time."
Ooh.
Mmm.
So parole officer Bernie Rhodes, and former FBI agent Russell Kalame favored the theory of McCoy as Cooper, and in 1991 published a book called, this is great, D.B. Cooper, The Real McCoy.
I mean, as books go, that is a very
good
title.
That's a good name. I feel like I should insert like a sound effect in there. Like, ba-dum-tsh. So, as well as the similarities that we've already talked about, they include in this book claims from McCoy's family that the clip-on tie and pearl tie clip left on the plane belonged to McCoy. Like Rackstraw, McCoy did not admit nor deny being Cooper and seemed okay with people believing either option. McCoy's widow, Karen, sued Rhodes, Kalame, and her former lawyer, and sought an injunction to prevent further publication and distribution of the book, citing that she and her involvement in the hijackings had been misrepresented. But during the court proceedings, it became known that Karen McCoy was deeply involved in the United Airlines hijacking. The injunction against further publishing and distribution was denied, but a conditional injunction against the sale of the film rights to the book was granted. She was awarded undisclosed settlements from the authors, $20,000 from the publisher, and $100,000 from her former lawyer.
Interesting. Yeah. So Karen McCoy died in 2020. And in 2021, her and Richard McCoy's children, Richard III, or Richard Jr. Jr., if you prefer, and Chante, yeah. I believe that's how her name is pronounced, who we think are in their mid-50s by now. They were born around late 60s, early 70s, because he was imprisoned in 72. They took part in a documentary where they admit that their father was D.B. Cooper and that their mother was involved in both the McCoy and Cooper hijackings. Now, according to Wikipedia, because we can't actually find this documentary anywhere, this is literally on the Wikipedia page for Richard McCoy, and the name of the documentary isn't even there.
Oh, documentary.
They took part in this documentary involving... I can't remember the name of the journalist off the top of my head, but yeah. Like, the name of it's not even there. But yeah, so according to Wikipedia page, there is evidence of a cover-up, and it also includes, in this documentary, an interview with Karen's sister Denise, where she admits that the sworn testimony she gave to the FBI in the 70s, that the McCoys were home for Thanksgiving in 1971... you know, the credible evidence that he was in Utah is actually false, and that in reality they were gone for 3 or 4 days during Thanksgiving week, and that she babysat her niece and nephew for them. And that is the story of D.B. Cooper and a very brief look at some of the potential suspects.
Oh, boy.
Thoughts, feelings, time.
I love this case. It just, like, it's another one of those that your brain can go off in a million different directions on, because there's so little information really that's been found over the last 45 years.
Well, it's 50 years yeah, now. True. 50 years last Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's right. But, yeah. So, one of the things that I always think about in this case also is the parachutes. So, he requested 4 parachutes. He got 4 parachutes. But, at least one of them was an instructor unit. And it was actually sewn shut.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the ones he jumped with.
So I always kind of wonder, like, but also if he was familiar with, so that's the question, like, was he familiar with parachutes? Because if he was, he wouldn't have worn that one to jump. He maybe just took it with him. Or was he not familiar with jumping out of a plane? And maybe he put that one on, and when he went to pull the ripcord, fuck all happened and he plummeted to his death. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting as well, because they revised the profile originally. They thought he was someone who knew about, like, had experience with parachuting and with skydiving, but then after a few years they're like, maybe not.
So I don't know. It's like really, it's tricky. It's like, you know, and it's also, I feel like, one of those things where, like, the second you read about a different suspect, you're like, oh, no, yeah, that could be the guy. Like, because they're so, it's just, you're grasping at straws, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, the smoking and the bourbon is, like, cited as being like, oh, well, he was also a smoker and a bourbon drinker, so it could be him. It's like... If you're using that, like you say, that was like every man in America in the 70s. Like, if that's part of your profiling, of course you're going to come up with thousands of suspects. Speaking of, so we didn't put this in the main script, but on the Wikipedia page on the list of suspects, our old friend John List is mentioned as a potential suspect.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you may remember, is it last year? Maybe even the year before, we did an episode on the List family murders. And John List murdered his entire family and was on the run for 20 years?
Yeah. Maybe a little more.
The details. But a forensic sculptor came up with this bust of how he, like, how they believed he would age. And it was shown on, like, America's Most Wanted or Unsolved Mysteries or something. One of those kind of shows. And he was found quite quickly after that. And the bust was exactly, like, you would have thought he was looking at him when he was making
it's
that
incredible.
Bust. This forensic sculptor. It, yeah. So yeah, if you haven't listened to that, go back, listen to it.
It's like episode 30-something, I want to say.
Is it? I didn't realize
maybe
it was that
it
early.
Was later, but it's, that was one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But yeah, John List was a potential suspect.
What's also interesting about List is that he disappeared in early November 1971. So I just looked it up. He disappeared after murdering his entire family on November 9th. So he, one of the reasons why he came up was because people were already looking for him. And so people were like, well, maybe he killed his whole family and then jumped out of a plane in Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, if you're on the run, you can't use like federal banks or anything.
Yeah.
So good way to get some money, but I don't think it was
no,
him.
And he even said after he was captured, he's like, that's not me. So
no,
but it is quite interesting that there's that connection. One of the other suspects that like I hadn't actually heard of until last week. that I feel like is more recent is Sheridan Peterson, who died
last year.
And so he served in the Marine Corps during World War II, worked at as a technical editor at Boeing, and was a smoke jumper and loved skydiving. And at one point, he said that the FBI, like, had good reason to suspect him. So, yeah, that's another interesting one.
Yeah. Well, like you say, your brain can go off in every direction looking at this case.
And I just feel like... Yeah, I don't know. Like I'm so impressionable on this case because I just want to know who it was. And I don't think we're ever gonna know.
I don't think we will, because especially if he was in his 40s, he's gonna be in his 90s now.
Yeah, so like Sheridan Peterson was 94 when he died last year.
Yeah. Richard Raxrod was in his 70s, he died a couple of years ago. You know, McCoy's widow died a couple of years ago, but he would have been, I believe, in his 70s or in his 80s, maybe, by now. So I don't think we will ever know who it was. But it's really interesting because this is the only unsolved air piracy case in the world in the history of commercial aviation.
That is really interesting.
Every other case has been solved in one way or another.
Yeah.
And so Florence Schaffner, one of the flight attendants, she spoke on Unsolved Mysteries, and I think she's spoken to other media outlets over the years. But Tina Mucklow has remained very private, very much removed from the media until this year, when she's finally spoken out about it, and she gave an interview to The Independent, which we've linked in the show notes. And there's a new film being made called Nod If You Understand. Mm-hmm. And it took filmmakers quite a long time to actually speak to her because she was like, I have no interest. I don't care. I don't want, you know, I've moved on with my life. And they're like, no, we want to tell your story, not his. We don't want to speculate on who he is. We want to tell your story. So that's going to start production soon, I believe.
Excited to see that.
But she talks in this interview about how people still, 50 years later, write to her. Like, she was 22 when this happened. And, like, she had the chance to run as well, like, because she was sent to get the parachutes and the money. She could have run. She could have stayed on the tarmac. She didn't have to get back on that plane, but she did. And people still write to her, being like, oh, I think it's this guy. And it's like, what are you fucking high?
Don't do that. That's not cool.
And she talks herself in this interview about like how people have made him into a folk hero. He's a domestic terrorist who threatened to kill 41 people.
And
that is who this man is.
And extorted hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. And I think that's the danger in these very long unsolved cases.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
That they build up this kind of folk hero and this myth. Like this mythos around them.
So yeah, I do wonder if because nobody was killed or injured in this whole incident, if that has helped sort of elevate him out of this like criminal thing into a like, a folk hero. Well, he stuck it to the man. He stole this money and disappeared into the wind. And
yeah, and it's like, we have no idea if that bomb was real or not. Nobody knows. Like, if that bomb was real and the slightest thing went wrong, like 41 people, including himself, would have been killed.
I think what's also really interesting about this case is that there's no real clear motive because a lot of the hijackings, and there were a lot of them at this time, they were political. They were like, well, take me to Cuba, you know, take me to this place, like, or
I mean, there's even a page on Wikipedia for, and it describes take me to Cuba, political dissidents.
Whereas this one, like, he didn't say, well, he said, you know, he wanted to go to Mexico City, but he clearly, like, that was just something to say to get them to fly, right? Because he bailed out over Oregon. So, did he do it just to stick it to the airline, to do it because to prove that he could, like, it's, you know, it's confusing. And I think that's why it's stuck for so long.
Yeah, people can ascribe their own meanings and values to it.
It's kind of like a blank slate, like, which does obfuscate the fact that, like, it's really fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, I find it a very, like, it is a very interesting case, and I do find the whole, like, air piracy hijacking of the, like, 50s, 60s, 70s quite interesting because, like, we've grown up in a world of very, very heavily regulated air travel. And, like, the idea is so foreign to just be able to, I mean, like, now you have to fill in API, like, 3 days before you fly. For most places, the advanced passenger information.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually quite difficult to walk up to an airport and get a flight now. Like, you used to be able to walk into an airport or travel agency the day before and be like, just give me your cheapest package to anywhere, like the Med or Long Haul or wherever. Like, that has become more difficult as well. So I find it very interesting that how long this kind of hijacking and air piracy went on with such frequency. It went on for going on for 30 years, like 50, 60, yeah. And into the 70s. But it's this case is actually pinpointed as the beginning of super heavily regulated air travel. So I find it interesting that this was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of regulation.
And security.
Because it was just so prolific throughout the 50s and 60s that it got to this case is generally pinpointed as being the one.
I think that probably it was just high profile enough, and probably the FBI and the US government was kind of embarrassed by it and was like,
They couldn't find him.
We should do something about this.
Yeah. So, final question. Do you think he actually survived?
Oh, it all comes down to those parachutes. Also, the money that was found. Because that's $6,000 just in that river, which makes me think.
Yeah.
Either he lost the money somewhere, like in the jump, and it went in the water and then the rest of it got carried out, or it went, you know, everywhere, as paper is wont to do. And maybe he survived. But I feel like he would have been caught if he had survived.
Because
you could never use that money.
No. But it's never been found apart from that $6,000. Yeah. So there's still $194,000. And it was all in 20s. That is a lot of $20 bills. Yeah,
that's true. I don't know.
So, because I like the McCoy theory, which obviously for that to have happened, he has to have survived. So I think he probably buried it, thinking, okay, if we bury it and we come back to it later, obviously he's lost some of it somewhere along the line. But I think he maybe buried it and possibly buried it in different bits, not like 194,000 altogether. Yeah. So that's why some of it's, you know, got lost. But then he then got arrested 5 months
Never
later.
Never went back for it.
And then died in a police shootout. Or FBI shootout. So he's never been able to go back and retrieve that
Unless
money.
Unless his wife did, if she was supposedly involved.
But yeah, that then depends how, like, to what extent she was really involved in. But yeah, so I think that's possible that it was buried, because that's how a lot of people get caught in, like, really big robberies, is they start flashing the cash. Like, we talked about the Lufthansa heist. The pink Cadillac. Like, you need to keep, like, a low profile for a while.
Well, I guess.
And potentially even take the money, like, go on holiday or fly abroad, take the money out of the country and exchange it abroad. Because there wasn't the same kind of checks on exchanging currency as there is now. Because they did, like, the money laundering laws we have now weren't around in the 70s.
And also,
so you could take it out of the country, exchange it, and then go fly and live somewhere on a tropical island where nobody knows you.
And, like, so if, say, he wanted to go to Mexico, like, if he survived the jump, maintained control over the money, and made it to Mexico by other means, you know, by getting on a train, whatever, then, I mean, he could potentially just take the cash and slowly, bit by bit, you know, $20 bill by $20 bill, exchange it for whatever currency wherever he was. And I think that's the key, too. Like, it would have to be. You couldn't just go up to, like, Banco Mexico, which is a real thing. That's not just an American racist adding an
El Banco de Mexico.
But like, you couldn't just rock up and be like, "Here's my 200,000 or $196,000. Please exchange it." Mm-hmm. But like, if he was just exchanging money with local merchants.
Well, that's the thing, because some places are happy to take US dollars, to take British pounds, to even to take euros in some places. I don't know, like, maybe Canadian or Australian dollars are the same as well. But yeah, in some countries where they have a lot of tourists from that country, they're quite happy to exchange, like, informally exchange.
Totally.
Currency that's not legal tender.
Yeah. So I don't know.
So
like,
yeah. But this is the thing where it's like your mind can go off in a thousand directions.
And also, like, I guess if you favor any particular suspect, you have to believe that they survived. Yeah.
They survived.
So
yeah. Because nobody just vanished on that day.
That we know.
But yeah, no, I think the money was probably, like, if he survived, whether it was McCoy or Christensen or someone else, I think the money is buried somewhere, you know, with a name to going back to it at some point when the heat is off, so to speak. And, like, if it was McCoy, obviously that didn't happen because less than 6 months later, he did the same thing but got arrested.
Was the United Airlines had a higher money ask.
Yeah, that was half a million.
Escalating, I could see that. Like, he's gotten away with it.
Yeah. He's got away with it using a fake bomb, so, or whether it was fake or real, because if it was real, like, how just, it must have turned up somewhere. Like,
that's what you would think, right?
That's what, but like you say, that's what we forget about. Like, he somehow kept a grip on his briefcase.
Yeah, right.
With a bomb. But the United Airlines was a paperweight looking like a hand grenade and an unloaded gun. So if McCoy is DB or was DB Cooper, it's possible that the bomb wasn't real as well. So, you know. But yeah. So, once again, we have solved nothing.
Solve the DB Cooper case. The greatest unsolved case in FBI history. I'm shocked.
Yeah, I mean, I know, I'm really disappointed in us. I thought we could do it when the feds couldn't.
Oh god, this has been like 2 hours long.
Has it? Oh fuck.
Crap.
Oh, you're getting a really long episode, guys. Hope you're still with us.
Some of that we can cut out some of that, but like, it is, I mean, I don't know. I'm quite happy with this to be a longer episode than we've been doing lately, because there's a lot to cover. There's a lot of stuff in here. But yeah, so I would really like to hear everyone else's favorite suspects or preferred theories of what happened after he jumped out of the plane. This is also another one of those, sorry to backtrack, but like, where, like, he just disappeared and nobody was watching at the time. It's another Alfred Lowenstein where, like, he's out the back of the plane, but everyone else is looking in the other direction. So, like, what if there was an inside man in the flight crew? And so, but I don't know where he would have been. So never mind. Don't listen to me.
Okay, you can cut this bit out.
No, I'm going to leave it in.
Oh, okay.
But like...
But yeah, it is interesting. Like, he jumped when no one was looking.
Yeah. So like, they think that he jumped at this time. I don't know. Yeah. Ah, I can't stop. Like, now that we've started this, I can't turn it off.
Okay,
anyway, tell us your theories.
Yeah.
Tell us your preferred suspects. Tell us if you are Dan Cooper.
Yeah. Dan, if you're listening.
So yeah, let us know. And here we go, guys. You're probably used to hearing this by now. Should probably rewrite this at some point.
Yeah, we should. But I mean, we can swap it around. I'll go if you want. We'll do each other's.
Sure. Sure.
So if you like the show, and why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Be sure to rate and review us on your podcast app of choice, if they allow, especially Apple Podcasts, because that helps us reach more people. And subscribe so you never miss a new episode, because why would you want to miss this?
Right?
I know. And if you want to get some cool Square Mile merch, we have a selection of awesome products with cool designs. You can get those at the link in our show notes on our website, or at just going straight to squaremileofmurder.store, I think.
Yes.
I should know the link.
You've heard me say it enough times.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes I just tune out when we get to this bit.
So do I, honestly. And dear God, listeners, I hope you do too. But if you haven't, and you are here and you are listening, and for whatever godforsaken reason you might like to help us cover the cost of making this show and help us invest in the future of the podcast, there is a way for you to do that by joining our Patreon page. Tiers start at just £1 per month. Every patron gets regular episodes a day early, a shout out on the show after you join, priority case requests, and a lifetime discount on merch. And that's all for £1 a month. As the tiers go up, you get even more cool stuff, including bonus episodes, some fun little goodies in the mail. Sometimes we release unedited versions of our episodes. We've been doing that a little bit more recently.
Yeah, I think we should do that more often.
Yeah.
She says, as though she has anything to do with that. As though she's the one that edits.
So if the parts of this podcast that you like most are the parts where we go off track, and you'd like to hear more unedited episodes, which
it'll
include
cost you £2 a month.
It'll cost you £2 a month, but we have that.
Yeah,
so
we do.
If that's something that interests you, you can check all of that out at patreon.com/squaremileofmurder. Links where you would expect to find them. That's
it. And we will be back next week. We'll see you then.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
If you're still here.
Dear God, go home. Go home, everyone.
Where do you think they are? They're probably all home. You can't really listen to this stuff in the office. Well, you can if you're me. I used to.
Yeah.
But I used to have an office to myself.
I mean, okay, don't go home. Stop doing the dishes.
Yeah. Take
just
a break.
Go do something else for a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. Goodbye.
Bye.